Vanderbilt University, this is Interview, a program of issues, ideas, and information about world-class research, people, and programs at Vanderbilt. I'm Emory Dear Owens. On this program, we'll learn more about the Senate confirmation hearings for John Roberts and find out about some unusual research. What happens when we see a gory or erotic image? More on that later. Joining us to preview the confirmation process is Stephanie Lindquist, Associate Professor of Political Science and Law at Vanderbilt. Stephanie teaches and writes about judicial politics and public law, including the impact of presidential nominations to the U.S. Supreme Court. Set the scene, if you can, for John Roberts' confirmation process, particularly now that he's the nominee for Chief Justice. How does that change the dynamics?
Well, it changes it in two ways. First, now he's replacing Rehnquist instead of O'Connor, and that changes the dynamics with respect to the interest groups involved in the process. They are going to be less, at least the liberal interest groups are likely to be less vociferous in their reaction to Roberts because he's essentially replacing someone who is very much like him. So it won't change the voting dynamics on the court. Secondly, as a Chief Justice, there are certain administrative responsibilities that he will hold, and therefore the senators will be interested in his administrative skills. The Chief Justice is essentially the chief bureaucratic officer, administrative officer for the courts. He is a person who interacts with Congress when it comes to budgetary considerations. He is the person who runs or has the final say on matters of administration and procedure within the courts. He is going to be in constant contact with the administrative office of the courts and the head of that agency. And he's going to be more concerned than the other justices will have to be with respect to case processing in the federal courts, how quickly cases move through the courts, how and whether or not judges are overburdened with caseload and that sort of thing. So his responsibilities will differ in that important respect administratively. Thirdly, as Chief Justice, he bears some administrative responsibilities within the court itself that are important. His vote is – he still remains one vote among nine equals. And so in terms of his voting capacity, it doesn't change – the change to being nominated as Chief Justice doesn't really change his impact on the court, obviously, in that sense. But if he is in the majority, voting in the majority, then he has the prerogative to assign the majority opinion. And that has been used by chief justices to their advantage in terms of shaping the doctrine that emerges from the court.
It would seem that he would have the temperament for being chief justice because he's one of those people that dots all his I's and crosses all his T's and is always very, very prepared, correct?
That's right. So in terms of his administrative skills, it seems to me that he's likely to be a very good administrator in terms of being very careful. The only problem he might face is micromanaging. I understand that he was actually involved in editing other people's memos, and he's done that in the past. So he might end up being somewhat of a micromanager. But nevertheless, he seems to be a very careful person that would probably be a good administrator. Also, he is an affable person. And one of the legacies of Chief Justice Rehnquist was that he was a very collegial member of the court. And that goes over well as in the role of Chief Justice. That's very important. I think that observers of the court will hope that he will be able to build, given his affability, he'll be able to build a stronger consensus in the court behind certain opinions. The court of late has become, even under the Chief Justice Rehnquist, has become very fragmented in the way that they announce their opinions with multiple concurrences, sometimes multiple dissents. And that makes it difficult for the lower courts to implement the rulings that the Supreme Court announces. And so I think there's some hope that, and probably questions will emerge at the hearings, regarding Judge Roberts' ability to marshal the court into a more collegial, consensus-oriented body. The purpose of the Senate Judiciary Committee here is to vet this nominee and to discover what his credentials are with respect to his appointment to the Supreme Court. And on this committee, there are 18 senators, 10 of whom are Republican and 8 of whom are Democrats. The Republicans obviously hold the majority of seats because they are a majority in the Senate. There are some very important senators on this committee. This is considered a plum committee. And so there are many high-profile senators that will be serving on this committee. Arlen Specter, of course, is the chair of the committee. He's a senator from Pennsylvania and a former prosecutor and is well known, of course, for his aggressive interviewing of Anita Hill during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings. He is also somewhat of an iconoclast and often takes positions that are contrary to the party line within the Republican Party. For example, he happens to be pro-choice, which sets him apart from most Republicans. He will be, of course, presiding over the committee and the hearings, and he will be negotiating. He'll negotiate with Senator Leahy from Vermont, who is the ranking Democrat on the committee, with respect to the types of questions that can be asked, the scheduling of the witnesses, and who those witnesses will be, who will be called by the committee. And, of course, John Roberts himself will be called to appear before the committee. So we can expect to see a number of witnesses called, John Roberts, et cetera. And the senators will have the opportunity to question these witnesses, and each senator will have that opportunity. I can discuss, if you like, the individual committee members. Would you like me to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Have most of these people been on the committee a long time?
Some of them have. Some of them have not. We have several former chairs of the committee that are sitting now, not no longer chairs, of course. Orrin Hatch from Utah, the very prominent member of the committee, will be aggressively defending John Roberts, has been very much a supporter of the Bush nominees to the judiciary since George Bush has been appointed or has been was elected to president. And he was one of the defenders of the nominees who wanted to strip the Democrats of their power to filibuster judicial nominees in the over the last year when that became an issue in the Senate. Also, of course, Senator Biden from Delaware is also a former chairman of the committee, presided over several former Supreme Court nominations, including Clarence Thomas, and so he will be very prominent.
And he's a possible candidate for president, too.
Indeed he is. And there are several people who have, obviously, Orrin Hatch ran for president at one point. There are several other committee members that will be interesting and will ask probably very aggressive questions. Among them, of course, is Charles Schumer of New York, who voted against Roberts when he was nominated to the Court of Appeals, and he has been very outspoken about conservative appointments to the courts. Senator Feinstein from California should take the lead in terms of asking questions about women's rights. She is the first and only woman on the committee, so she'll probably play a pivotal role when it comes to questions regarding women's rights. Edward Kennedy, of course, is also on the committee, and he should be and has been outspoken in the media with respect to Roberts' confirmation, expressing concern that he'll roll back rights for minorities, etc. On the Republican side, we have Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, and he was one of the original members of the Gang of 14 that constructed the compromise to avoid the constitutional crisis regarding the filibuster in the Senate. And he has often taken somewhat unusual positions like Specter in terms of Republican Party platform. So he could be an interesting member of this committee in terms of the questions that he asks. There are also some very, very serious conservatives on the committee who have not been extremely outspoken in support of Roberts because they're not sure exactly what his position is going to be with respect to abortion. Here I'm thinking of Senator Brownback of Kansas and Senator Coburn of Oklahoma. These are staunch abortion opponents and, again, have not indicated clear enthusiasm given Roberts' unclear views about abortion at this point. So we might see some questions from them, especially in terms of their constituency. They've been playing to their constituency and trying to find out exactly what Roberts' position might be with respect to abortion.
Now, John Roberts has been before this same committee three times before?
Two times, as far as I know, with respect to the Court of Appeals.
And does that experience serve him well as he goes up again? I mean, can he pretty much expect what the questions will be?
Yes, he can absolutely expect what the questions will be. Certainly, some of these senators have questioned other nominees, as I said, the ones especially who have the most experience in this regard. So he can look to old hearing transcripts to find out what kind of questions are likely to be asked. In addition, what we have here is a very cool customer. This is someone who's argued 40 or 50 times before the U.S. Supreme Court, who is a meticulous, is meticulously detail-oriented with respect to all of his work and has been with respect to all of his work before the court and in terms of his legal representation of clients. So he will be well-prepared and will not be ruffled by questions asked by the committee members. I have every expectation that he'll perform extremely smoothly before this committee.
I got the impression when he was introduced that he's very used to speaking before large groups, almost could be a media star in the right role.
Absolutely. I think, and he would have honed those skills before the Supreme Court. Arguing before the Supreme Court is one of the most rattling experiences for most attorneys that there is, because the members of the court will interject questions in the middle of sentences, et cetera. And obviously, it's the most prestigious place to argue in the United States. So his ample experience before the court should enable him to be very fluid with respect to his answers to questions of the committee.
Do you think that the Democrats will press Roberts more now that he's been nominated as Chief Justice as opposed to just being a justice?
They may. Certainly, arguably, the Chief Justice is clearly, he is the Chief Justice of the United States. He is probably the most important judicial officer that we have. And so they may be more concerned to some degree about his past record, et cetera, and the degree to which he is going to vote in a conservative manner. But frankly, the Chief Justice, even though he does have some moderate control over policymaking that emerges from the policymaking by the court, in the sense that he can assign the majority opinion and he is first among equals, his actual impact on the court probably in terms of policy is not that much stronger than if he was going to be nominated an associate justice. Chief justices can only do so much in terms of pressing the court to achieve a particular agenda. For example, Justice Rehnquist was very concerned about states' rights, and that was his federalism, really was his agenda, his particular agenda item. And he made some inroads because he had some allies in that area. But the court also rendered some decisions that strengthened the power of the federal government as well. And here I'm thinking of the recent decision involving the use of marijuana for medical purposes. And the court upheld the federal government's ability to restrict a state's ability to do that. And that happened in the recent term. So not a perfect record in terms of his federalism agenda.
What role have any of the groups that normally support women's rights and are pro-choice, what role have they played so far? Has their role been somewhat understated?
I think it has, because they made some ill-advised moves at the beginning in terms of attacking this nominee with some controversial television spots. And so I think to some degree they undermined their own impact by taking what appeared to many to be an extreme position with respect to the nominee. And it's interesting, in terms of the role of women's groups, often they get it wrong. It's not necessarily clear at this point that Roberts is a vote to overturn Roe versus Wade, for example. We don't have any evidence to that effect. History informs us that sometimes, as I said, these interest groups misunderstand the nature of the nominee. For example, when Justice Stevens was nominated by the Ford administration, women's interest groups came out vociferously in opposition to his nomination, which in retrospect we realized was a mistake on their part. Stevens is now one of the most strongest supporters of women's rights on the court, and probably the most liberal voting member on the court.
How unusual is it that Fred Thompson, our former senator from Tennessee, would be managing Roberts' nomination? I mean, is this the first time we've had a really high-profile former senator do this?
As far as I know, there have been certainly high-profile senators who have been champions of nominees. So, for example, Senator Danforth was an outspoken champion in support of Clarence Thomas's nomination and was outspoken about his opposition to Anita Hill's testimony. As far as I know, this is the first time that a president has actually appointed essentially a PR committee to monitor and to manage the profile of a nominee in the public image. There have been lobbyists who have been appointed as insiders, in effect, to inform the nominee about senatorial procedures, et cetera, and to manage it from the inside. But this time we have Ed Gillespie, former chairman of the Republican National Committee, and Fred Thompson being selected essentially as PR representatives of this nominee.
Now, is his role more behind the scenes, perhaps meeting with some of the senators, or would he actually be speaking before the committee?
As far as I know, he probably won't be speaking before the committee. What he'll be doing is vetting questions with the nominee, making sure the nominee is aware of what questions he can expect to be asked, ensuring that the media coverage of the nominee's experience, et cetera, is fair and balanced, perhaps managing some of the conservative interest groups and ensuring that they're getting their story straight, et cetera.
What senators do you think will be most vocal on the committee?
I think Leahy is likely to be, as a ranking member, likely to be very vocal. Specter, as the chairman, is not likely to be vocal in the sense that he wants to play a neutral role. But he will be vocal on one particular issue that I can anticipate. Spector has expressed concern about the Supreme Court's second-guessing of Congress when it comes to enacting legislation. And he is very, very sensitive to the cross-institutional tensions that exist between the Congress and the court. And in recent decisions, the court has struck down various congressional enactments on grounds that Congress did not lay the proper factual foundation for enacting the legislation, especially with respect to the congressional power to regulate interstate commerce and to enact legislation pursuant to the 14th Amendment. And Spector essentially took umbrage at the Supreme Court's challenge to Congress with respect to its factual development underlying these statutes. And so I think that what we'll see is Spector asking the nominee questions about congressional power and his views of congressional power in an effort to ensure, at least from his from Spector's standpoint, that the nominee will not vote to overturn congressional enactments and will respect Congress's power.
Do you think John Roberts will be asked about eminent domain, since that was a controversial issue?
I would not be surprised if he was asked about that. And as far as I know, there is no pending case on the court's docket for next term that would enable him to dodge such a question on grounds that he's likely to be ruling on it in the short term. When it comes to questions about abortion, of course, there is an important case pending on the court's docket involving exceptions to parental consent for minors when there is a pending an imminent health issue for that minor. Questions regarding the right to choose are likely to the nominee is likely to argue that he can't answer questions with respect to abortion, given the fact that there's going to be an abortion case on the docket. And that would be reasonable from his standpoint. In fact, when Justice Ginsburg was questioned by the committee, she also declined to answer questions like that. And Senator Biden respected that choice on her part. And in fact, some of the statements he made with respect to her decision not to answer questions about abortion, for example, have been raised now to challenge him and to ensure that he won't ask similar questions of this nominee.
How many votes will be needed to move it out of committee? Is it just a majority vote?
Majority vote to move it out of committee, and then, of course, a majority vote on the Senate floor to confirm the nominee. I'm calling him the candidate in some respects because the media campaign and the appointment of Fred Thompson suggests more of a campaign on his part as a candidate rather than as a nominee to the Supreme Court.
Will there be any appropriate time for Roberts to speak to the press, or is that something Supreme Court justices rarely do?
They rarely speak to the press. They'll often make statements or give speeches before organizations, and that's very common and has been extremely common on the part of certain justices, such as Justice Scalia. After Clarence Thomas concluded his confirmation process, he gave an extensive interview to People magazine, and they ran a very extensive story about him with photographs, et cetera, of his family, his wife, in their home. So it's not unprecedented for a candidate to give interviews to the media, but it is frowned upon, quite frankly, and I think that didn't elevate the profile of Clarence Thomas in ways that he might have preferred. I think some people thought that was inappropriate for him to give that interview to People magazine. So I think given how careful this nominee is with respect to everything he has done in his career, and he is a remarkable, has built a remarkable career based upon the care with which he conducts himself professionally, I would be very doubtful that he would give an interview to the press.
Do we envision that Roberts possibly prepared himself to be the protege of Rehnquist all along? I mean, is that something that's typical for a clerk?
Certainly he would have revered and did revere and respect Rehnquist, and their views appear to be remarkably consistent in many matters. His clerking for Rehnquist at an early age might have helped shaped him in terms of continuing him on that trajectory in which he looks very much like Rehnquist in his opinions about the Constitution, about balance of powers among the branches of government, et cetera.
Is it typical for the president to select someone as Chief Justice who has not already been a justice on the Supreme Court?
Yes, it's not uncommon. Warren Burger was selected from the Courts of Appeals to immediately become Chief Justice, as was Earl Warren, who was governor of California. So he was not even in the judiciary when he was appointed to be Chief Justice. So that's not uncommon. Rehnquist, of course, had served in the court for some time before he was elevated. But this is a nice way for Bush to basically kill two birds with one stone. If he was going to elevate someone from within the court, he'd have to go through another confirmation hearing for the chief justiceship for that justice. So, for example, if he wanted to elevate Scalia, it would require another confirmation hearing. And it may be something that, especially given Hurricane Katrina, George Bush would prefer to avoid.
Now, if Roberts is confirmed, but they still have the vacancy for Sandra Day O'Connor, how will that affect the proceedings?
Sandra Day O'Connor, in her letter of resignation, indicated that she would step down as soon as her successor was announced. And I expect that she'd like to step down and not begin the new term. So she might write a second letter of resignation in which she resigns even in the face of the vacancy. And we'll have to see if that comes to pass. If she does do that, then the court will be faced with deciding cases, potentially at least in the short term, with only eight justices on the court. The problem with that, and this court only needs six justices to constitute a quorum, so they can decide cases with less than nine justices. But the problem is that where you have an evenly numbered court, you have the potential, obviously, for evenly divided opinions, evenly divided decisions. And where a decision is evenly divided, it results in the automatic affirmance of a lower court. So it saps the court of its ability in many ways to reverse lower court judgments when the court is divided. So it's not optimal, obviously, for the court to only have eight members. Always better to have an odd number on the court rather than an even number.
Stephanie Lindquist is an associate professor of political science and law at Vanderbilt and an expert on judicial politics. Some Vanderbilt research has shown that viewing erotic or gory images can actually cause temporary blindness, somewhat similar to what happens when there is a bad traffic accident and drivers take their eyes off the road to stare as they drive by. Our guest is David Zald, an assistant professor of psychology at Vanderbilt, whose primary line of research revolves around the neural basis of emotional processing. Why did you decide to do this? Was this an extension of earlier research?
Well, we were primarily interested in how emotion interacts with attention. And there's been a little bit of work in this area over recent years, finding that, for instance, emotional stimuli can draw our attention. But no one had really looked at what the effects were after an emotional stimulus had already passed. And what we were interested in is what's the effect that goes on even after that picture, say, of an emotional image isn't there anymore.
What do you mean by the term temporary blindness? I know you said that when the people see the gory or erotic image, they have this temporary blindness. Is it like their eyes go black? Or?
Well, we use the term temporary blindness not so much to say that the person is truly blind. They're obviously still getting information that's impacting their eyes, going back into primary visual areas, but is not moving forward in the brain into a point where they're conscious of it. And so we refer to it as a blink or a temporary blindness because they're literally not seeing things that are happening. Even though they're hitting their eyes, they're not being able to become consciously aware of them.
How did you conduct this research? Was this involving some kind of magnetic resonance imaging, or how did you do this?
In this case, these studies were purely behavioral. What we did is we showed people pictures going by very fast on a computer screen. In fact, each picture was only up for about 100 milliseconds. So if you think about viewing a TV, like an MTV type video, where they're just flashing these images very quickly. And what we did is we simply asked people to indicate whether we had an image in there that was turned to the left or the right. And in every set of images where we'd show them about 17 images in a row, they knew there was going to be one that was going to be rotated to the right or the left. All they had to say was which way. What we would then do is introduce a picture which had emotional content, such as a gory picture, a picture of a gun pointing at you, or an erotic picture. And we'd introduce that into the stream of pictures, and we'd see if that would interfere with detecting the target, which was this rotated image.
So they had to identify which image was rotated?
That's right. All they're asked to do is identify which image is rotated, which they can do. Most people can do this at a better than 90% accuracy if we're not introducing anything to distract them.
So you found that in general, when the people saw the gory or erotic image, then that prevented them maybe from seeing the image that was rotated?
Exactly. And people will say, they'll describe, I didn't see anything on that trial. And so there, in the cases where we are introducing these pictures, these emotional pictures, soon before the target, they're simply not able to readjust their attention back to detecting the target because the attention has essentially gone through a log jam where they can only actually attend to one picture at a time. And if they're stuck on the emotional picture, it prevents them from being able to shift to processing the new information.
Did you find any difference in gender with this?
We have not seen gender differences so far. Certainly with the gory images, we've seen no real evidence of gender differences. With some of the erotic images, we thought we might see some large differences. And there might still be some there, but at least if we're using erotic couples, which we figure should be equally appealing to both genders, we're not seeing large evidence of gender differences. My suspicion is that there may be something subtle, but it's not a strong effect.
Do you think this research will lead, will it lead to additional research, or will you be calling for any type of policy change?
We ourselves are not calling for any policy changes based on this. It is the case that we've gotten several inquiries from groups which are interested in perhaps regulation of billboards along highways. We've been contacted by a couple lawyers who thought that this might be relevant in certain car crash cases, injury cases. We ourselves have primarily just been interested in understanding how the brain works, and so we're not making any claims beyond the fact of what we see in these studies seems to be a very robust phenomena, that people do have this temporary period where they're unable to process information very well.
Is it because they're processing that more slowly? Why is there that distraction?
It seems that these areas of the brain that are involved in critically determining what we're attending to are really limited in how many things they can attend to at once. And if something's important, it will almost pop out. And you can even sometimes, while we view these rapid streams, you get the sense of almost time slowing as you see this picture, this emotional picture, for longer than it really was out on the screen. So there's almost this pop-out effect that happens. And when you get that, that very slowing of the sense of slowing of time for the emotional image is then compressing whatever's coming afterwards, and you may not even see what came afterwards.
For a person maybe that didn't like looking at these images, say they had a real aversion to violence, they never went to any R-rated, violent movies or whatever, would they be as slow, or do they maybe just kind of move on quickly and not really try to process it?
Actually, they're probably more distracted by it. The people who have a hard time processing those sorts of images are probably going to have even more problems. Our suspicion is that if we did this with a bunch of surgeons for our gory images, that they would show very little effect. Our own experience from having worked with these sorts of horrendously nasty sorts of images for the past year is that they don't have as much effect on us as they used to, so that we don't even have the same degree of a blink as we probably did originally.
Did you use all different ages for your study?
We've only done young adults in these studies. A lot of our studies are with college students or with people from the general Nashville community, but usually these are people who are either college age or mostly in their 20s. The other people who we did this work with, Steve Most, who was actually the lead author, and Marvin Chun and David Witters. Marvin Chun was on faculty here at Vanderbilt for several years, and his postdoctoral fellow, Stephen Most, who worked with Marvin as well as myself, he was working here too. And so we started all these experiments actually at Vanderbilt before Marvin and Steve went to Yale, where they've been continuing on, and Steve's been coming back here on a regular basis to continue to work on these studies with me.
Our guest has been David Zald, an assistant professor of psychology at Vanderbilt, whose expertise includes neuroimaging and neuropsychology. You have been listening to Interview, a production of the Division of Public Affairs at Vanderbilt University. If you have a question or comment about Interview, you can contact us at 615-322-2706.